All right.
Okay. Welcome to the Thereafter Podcast, a place where we explore life on the other side of faith change.
We're here to break down the binaries, deconstruct the dualities, and wander through what it looks like to live in the gray.
In church, we were told that life after leaving would be a bitter wasteland of unfulfilling hedonism, but we've discovered quite the opposite.
There's actually a vibrant community of people on the other side of faith who are finding and co-creating space for hope and healing.
Come along as we explore the all too often uncharted expanse of evangelicalism, evolving faith, and the life thereafter.
All right. It's Cortland here, along with Megan. Megan, how are you doing today?
Hey, I'm good. I'm healthy-ish. We've got ice outside in Portland. We're good. We're hunkering down.
We need ice here. We need any type of moisture here. We've had like no moisture in Colorado. And today, part of Colorado, not too far from me, caught on fire.
No.
Yeah.
It is not fire season.
Yeah, they had to close part of the highway because there was a huge grass fire that I think is still burning as we speak.
Yeah,
so
no, that
here
is...
Here we are.
We were supposed to get a huge storm. I think Seattle got the brunt of it, but my family raced home from Chicago. We changed our flight to an earlier flight and ended up getting really nothing, and it was a huge disappointment because we were excited to see snow and wake up to snow, and it didn't happen.
On Christmas, like you were supposed to get a storm like on Christmas, huh?
Yeah.
And no snow happened.
Yeah. Bummer. And I love that anticipation of, hey, we might be stuck in the house for a couple days and grab your gallon of milk and loaf of bread and hunker down. And
yeah.
But nothing. I mean, yeah, it was.
We've had like nothing here. It's been, I think we did finally get measurable snow, but I think it was like the longest, like since like the 30s or something, the latest in the year that it's been before we've gotten measurable snow. But yeah, it's weird. The weather is a strange thing, but it is post Christmas here. We survived. You survived traveling. You're back home.
Yeah.
And healthy. That's exciting.
And we're in that weird in between Christmas and New Year's where it's kind of blah, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to work. I work today and then I work for the next 2 days and then 4 more days off. So it's like, it's a weird time. Nobody at the office wants to be there. Like, I don't know why we're there, to be honest. It's like,
I have a question for you. So do you get offended when people text you Merry Christmas now that you're an atheist? Because I didn't know what to text my atheist friends. I was like, happy family together time.
Good question. I don't get offended. Christmas doesn't bother me. Like, it doesn't offend me. I do feel kind of strange. And it feels weird being on this side of faith change that there is so much presumed participation in such a Christian holiday. Like I wouldn't get offended if my Muslim friends or coworkers told me happy Ramadan, or, you know, my Jewish friends told me happy Hanukkah. Like it doesn't offend, like it's not an offense at all. But it does seem weird that there's an assumed, it's not a Christian holiday. I mean, it is a Christian holiday, but it's like an American corporate holiday, right? Like,
yeah.
And I do wish that I could opt out. Like, I wish that I could like not participate, because it does feel like a lot of pressure to be involved in a holiday that I don't feel like we need to be celebrating. I don't want to get like weird about like, oh, no holidays. My kid loves Christmas. He loves presents. You know, I like the idea of it. Like, I'm not to the point where I'm like anti Jesus or Christmas or any of that.
Or presents. But,
or presents. But I do like, I don't like all the pressure. I'm not a, like, I like gift giving. Like, I got you a gift, right? Like a couple months ago, because I just saw this thing and I was like, ooh, Megan needs that. I'm going to buy it for her. And I just texted you. It was like, I got you something. It'll be at your house in 2 days, right? Like, that's how I do gift giving. I didn't get you anything for Christmas. I didn't get anything for anybody for Christmas. Like, literally nobody. My son included. Like, my wife got presents for my son.
Yeah.
And I paid for them, I guess, to some extent. But like, I just don't like the pressure of like, okay, I have to think about every single person. And then you have to decide, like, is this a person who's getting me something? And then what about the people who get you something who you weren't expecting? Do you have to have like backup gifts to be able to give to the unexpected people you get gifts from? I don't know. It's just, it's so much social pressure. I don't like it.
And thoughtful gift giving, I think, is a talent. I don't have that talent, but I do. When people give me a thoughtful gift, I'm like, oh, that is so nice. I wish I was that thoughtful. So
I think I can do it, just not for everybody all at once. And then like, I also have a lot of holiday. My niece's birthday is like right before Christmas. My wife's birthday is right before Christmas. My brother-in-law's birthday, several of my good friends, their birthday is like the week before. So it's like that too, like adds to the like, okay, so I've got all these birthdays that are going on. So I got to get them a gift for that. And then Christmas. And then it's just like, it just feels like too much all at once. And I would rather just get people things throughout the year when it feels right.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. I like it.
But I don't get offended. It is, I think, a cool and can be a beautiful like holiday. And I really like the downtime. I love Christmas like culture in terms of like movies. Like we've been watching since Halloween, basically. Like we started with, you know, Nightmare Before Christmas on Halloween. And then like since then, we've been watching Christmas movies in my house every week, 2-3 movies a week, usually 2 or 3 every weekend. I love Christmas movies.
Okay, but Home Alone is my staple.
Home Alone is great. We watched Home Alone, and Home Alone 2 is still decent. No other Home Alone is worth watching ever. Yeah. But Home Alone 2 is worth watching. It's okay. But I watch Home Alone every year. We watch Christmas Vacation every year. We watch Elf every year. Political opinions aside, Tim Allen's Santa Claus is still, like, I think, a classic. We watch that every year. We watched It's a Wonderful Life this year. For the first time in a long time.
That one's hard. It takes too long for me to get happy again, you know?
It is a sad one.
Can we just watch like the last 10 minutes every year and not watch the whole thing?
Yeah, it is. It's a sad one. Did you know that movie bombed? That movie was like no one liked it when it came out.
No,
then,
I did not know that.
And then it became a classic like years afterwards. I think it was like several years, maybe a decade plus after it came out, that it became like a Christmas classic. It's always weird, those things. So we don't have a ton. We talked about like not a ton's been happening on the internet, in the Twitter sphere.
I gotta say, one of my favorite things that happened this week, though, it was kind of dead. Everybody was kind of doing family time. But so I sent out a tweet that said, what fictional character do I remind you of? And Peter Fenton, man, he came through with our dynamic duo, fictional character from Zootopia. Yes. I loved it. Yes. Oh gosh, what are their names? Nick?
Too. Nick and
Judy?
Judy. I wanted to say Nora, like Nick and Nora's.
No.
That's a movie.
The Fox and the Bunny from Zootopia. He was like, you and Portland just have that vibe. And I was like, oh, that is so perfect. And
I don't think I put off as cool of vibes as Nick, though. Nick seems cooler than me. I'm a little intimidated to
I'm probably as high strung as Judy.
I'm not that cool, but I did think it was a good fitting Peter Fenton shout out, guest from last season. We love Peter.
Yeah. So, and cool. As far as Twitbits, you mentioned something, Cortland.
We can talk about Perry Stone, I guess. I didn't even know the motherfucker's name until today, but apparently he's like a, I don't know, apocalyptic, prophetic megachurch weirdo from Tennessee. He's got a YouTube channel, still pumping out content to this day. He put out a video today. But there was a big article, a big expose, because there's been allegations of sexual abuse, sexual assault, and of course, it's a standard line. I think the board came out. He said something like, oh, I let my guard down. And then he tried to say that he's just Italian, and so he gets real touchy with people because he's Italian.
Wow.
Apparently, and like people just don't understand. But then they did this big expose today saying like, no, there's like legitimate complaints of him like having, like making his erection known through his clothes and like giving people unwanted back rubs and touching people and kissing people and various other sexual assault types of behaviors. And then he posted a YouTube video, like basically saying that the secular media can't be trusted because
fake
they don't
news.
Have the integrity of Christians, and you can't trust any news coming from non-Christian media outlets that are just trying to sell newspapers. And I don't know, man, it's just like the same story over and over and over again.
It is amazing. It's mind blowing to me how people have that happen and immediately claim that they're being persecuted. It's like, okay, yeah. You know, you did this shitty thing and now you're claiming that people are out to get you and you're being persecuted and you're losing this and that. And it's like, no, you know, oh man.
Yeah. And it's just like I just don't think that there is any way for someone in that type of religious, like when you're like he posted some video. I went into a rabbit hole today watching some stuff about this lunatic, but like he posted some video where he had a dream about these seven fish or something. And then he kills one of the fish. And the meaning was that somebody who's opposing his ministry was either going to die or be killed because of them. Like, it's just like all this, like, and like, it sounds crazy. It literally, like, to me, being as far outside of it as I am, and I don't know, I mean, you came from a relatively charismatic background, right, Megan?
Well, I would say I didn't dabble in the charismatic until a little bit later on, so.
Okay, but you've been in charismatic spaces.
Yeah.
There's no way that you have this apostolic, charismatic, prophetic, environment and you don't have abuse. Like, it's almost impossible for it to exist. And it sucks, I guess, to say that, because it's like, it feels like I'm writing off like a huge chunk of, you know, people who have a belief system, but it's just like, it's just so rife and just so ready to be abused when you have people believing that you are telling the future and that you're hearing literal God's, you know, God's literal voice, and that you have this man of God or this apostle that is saying these things. I mean, I literally experienced in the ministry that I worked at, and it wasn't even a charismatic. I mean, the church I was at was not charismatic. But people opposing, more than one occasion, people who opposed the cult ministry that I was involved in ended up dying in tragic accidents. And leadership behind closed doors attributed their death to their opposition of our ministry.
Wow.
like
that is
literally
mind-blowing.
It happens. Like, and so, I don't know, like, maybe I am jaded, but it's hard for me to see anything like that and not feel like there's abuse. There's abuse, and there is that entire structure just sets people up to be manipulated and abused. And I just am so tired of it.
I have a rant about the prophetic. I don't know if now's the time, but
I mean, go for it.
I definitely
rant.
There was a time when I had some people that I had followed on Instagram and whatnot that were quote unquote well-known prophets, and some of them were associated with Bethel and other places. And these were the prophets that predicted that Trump was still supposed to be president. And I would say that they were complicit in what happened on January 6th. And then on, that was a Wednesday. On that Friday, more than one of them came out and said an apology. Oh, you know, like we had prophesied this, but sometimes you get it wrong. Never said anything about January 6th. And so many people just went in droves to their pages saying, oh, you're so humble. We just, yeah, that was such a great thing that you just can be so humble. And I was like, this is bullshit. Like these
Dude,
people. Oh,
it really
man.
Is.
It was, that was when I cut all ties to listening to worship music and all of that. Cause I was like, man, this is so toxic. The way that people are trying to say they've cornered the market on this direct communication with some kind of divine that's going to tell you who's going to be president. And it's going to start a wave of people that think they're entitled to storm the Capitol. And I mean, I was just, that was a huge piece of me unraveling a year ago and more than a year ago. So,
yeah, the authoritarian nature of just the whole fucking thing, the whole system. And it's interesting. This is one other thing that I was just DMing with Will Thorpe. Shout out to Will Thorpe, Heretical Theology, a good friend of Megan and I's, and who's back. And posting some great content on Instagram.
It's great. It's great to see him back.
It is. It really is. But I had this guy popping up a lot in my Instagram or in my TikTok feed. And I have to pull it up because I can't talk about him and not name him. But there's a guy who's got a TikTok channel. And is that what it's called? I don't know. Channel account?
I don't know. I'm not on TikTok. I'm afraid.
I'll go on
the rabbit hole.
You got to get on Dan McClellan. Have you heard of Dan McClellan?
It sounds really familiar, but no.
He's on Instagram too. He's got 100,000 followers on TikTok. And he does this. He's got this stuff on TikTok and he's very clear in his, he's got an intro video and his videos just keep popping up. I saw one and I liked it. And then, another
the
one.
The algorithm got
it.
You, huh?
Yeah, it got me. And then he's just been in my feed just constantly. And it's really interesting. He's got like 5 master's degrees from like all over. I think he went to BYU originally and then ended up going to Oxford for a master's degree and then like multiple other universities. I think he's got like 2 masters and like 2 PhDs or 2 masters and a PhD. The guy's educated, right? And I was DMing Will about it because he works for the LDS Church as a translator, for a scripture translator. And he's very clear on his page that he doesn't, his channel or his page doesn't represent his profession or his personal faith. But he is a Mormon professing, believing Mormon who works for the LDS Church. And yet his scriptural criticism, his textual criticism is pretty fucking spot on. Like every video I watch, I'm like, okay, this guy's really smart. He's taking a really like academic, intellectual approach to textual criticism of these texts, right? I don't know how somebody does that and still maintains faith. It's fascinating and works as an employee of the church. You know, like I don't know how you do those things. It's really interesting to me.
Like nobody sat him down in a room with all the elders or deacons and said, look, we've seen your Instagram. TikTok.
I can't imagine that the church is happy. I mean, he's sitting on here like saying these things that like pretty specifically don't specifically contradict, but I think there was even one video where he was like, my opinion of this specifically contradicts church doctrine on this topic, but this is what the textual criticism of this passage says. And I think it was specifically about homosexuality. And he was saying there is no scriptural basis for a rule against or a command or a charge against homosexuality. he's like, it's just not there, right? There are various different things. And here's, you know, a few different pieces of background on, you know, translation and, you know, textual analysis and whatever. But there's no, you know, clear condemnation of homosexuality in scripture. And yet that is the doctrine of the LDS church. So I don't know. Maybe he's a guest we should have, because I just want to pick his brain as to like, how can you hold those two things at the same time? How can you be intellectually curious and intellectually honest and yet still be a person who claims this faith that feels like you have to be intellectually dishonest to participate? And there's Christian examples of that too. People who I know who are a part. Oh, I guess that's the other thing that happened. Beth Moore is an Anglican now. Did you see that?
Yeah. Twitter came out in full force to talk about Beth Moore during the holidays. Yeah. Somebody spied on her at her church and her online service and took screenshots, and in an effort to discredit her and her faith. But I just think, you know, if you ever want to ignite people from all over Twitter, just throw shade on Beth Moore, because people just went all out.
Yeah. That was an interesting thing that happened. But anyway, I don't know. I just don't know how I feel about, like, I feel like I'm very curious about people who can maintain a practicing faith, you know, and I mean, you still maintain a practicing faith.
Maybe yourself. A faith, maybe not a practicing faith. I don't
know. Yeah.
I don't know. I think Will would probably say that about me, though. He would probably say, like, not knowing now this and that, how could you still call yourself a progressive Christian? And, you know, but not in that way.
I guess I don't know. For me, it feels different with folks like you, who you don't align yourself with. It's not like you work for Bethel, right? Like, if you worked for Bethel and maintained your perspective that you have now while simultaneously working for, you know, the Southern Baptist Convention, you know, like, how do you do that, right? How do you, like, oh, I'm a practicing, you know, you're not a part of the Baptist, or you're not a part of this institution. You are your own person with your own ideas about faith, which I think arguably I have ideas about faith, even as an atheist.
Yeah.
But I'm not associating or identifying with a particular institution. You know, you just call yourself Christian, but that's a really, really broad term. And there are aspects of Christian tradition or subsects of Christian tradition that I think probably do represent your views and perspectives and theologies. But it really blows my mind when I have another friend, he listens to this podcast. And so I'll be careful about how I talk about, but he works for a relatively conservative church, and I know he has theological differences with the church, and yet he still is willing to work for and with this denomination and with this church. And like, I'm not throwing shade. I'm not saying that it's inauthentic. I'm just like, I wrestle with, like, I wouldn't be able to, like, manage the cognitive dissonance that goes, like, I'm not convinced of this, but in order to participate professionally in this religion.
Yeah, I mean, I think some people have that cognitive dissonance, and some people don't have another means of income, for at least for a while. I mean, we've talked about that on this show before with Joe Lumen, and people that don't have another outlet once you leave. And I mean, I sat with a single mom friend of mine that was a full-time volunteer nursery coordinator at a church that we used to go to together, and got divorced and didn't have a source of income and didn't have a resume to show for it. And it was a hard climb back out of that. And so I think, you know, for some people, you stay in for a little while when you have an income, have a community that will support you for a while. And then, you know, some people it is just the cognitive dissonance, like, oh, I can play the game. I can talk the talk and do that sometimes, and then have my own internal struggle and separate that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess back to, like, even the John Steingart interview that we did, where he talked about, there's, to some extent, there is that in every career, right? Like, I work for a company that's, like, pretty dependent on the oil and gas industry to some extent, right?
Yeah.
Like, I can't be a radical, you know, anti-fracking, you know, activist and authentically keep my job. I mean, I can, yeah. I guess, but I have to realize that the practical aspect of my employment does, you know, does create cognitive dissonance between what I might believe about fossil fuels.
Yeah. You know? No, that is true. That was, I remember John saying that. That was a good point. I do think we should introduce Josh Scott, who we have coming up this interview. I just have to say, Cortland, that I feel like we keep having these guests on that are pastors like Pastor Judy and Josh Scott. And I feel like through the course of the interview, you're always like pastored. you're like, tell me more. This is really speaking to me. And I love it. I mean, I feel that way too, but I just, yes. I feel like you end and you're like, wow, that was really good. It spoke to me.
I love it. I love it. And we get into it a little bit in this interview. I remember talking about my experience, talking with Josh about my experience with Christian community. There's an aspect of Christian community and that pastoring type of relationship that I really enjoy, you know, and do appreciate. And it's cool to be able to have connection and conversations with people of faith who actually genuinely engage with me and you and us and anyone listening. Even though we're all maybe in different places. So I love that. So yeah, let's get into it. Josh Scott, pastor of
Grace Point Church in Nashville, Tennessee.
Let's get into it, folks.
Welcome back to the Thereafter podcast. I'm Megan Crozier. I'm here with my co-host, Cortland Coffey.
Hello.
And we've got Josh Scott on our podcast today. We're really excited about this interview. Hey, Josh, how's it going?
It's going great. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. So, Josh, I have so much I want to ask you about the work you're doing now. But before we get to that, I would love to hear, I don't know much about your journey and how you kind of got to where you are today. And so if you can tell us a little bit about how you kind of landed in the deconstruction community. I don't know if that's what you call yourself as landing there, but just how you kind of got yeah. started in
however
here.
You got wherever you are, you know,
exactly. And we'll just
wherever you kind of came from. We like to get the backstory.
It's a story. That's for sure. It's a story. So I grew up, I was born in the Appalachian region of Eastern Kentucky, West Virginia. And I grew up in a holler in Eastern Kentucky. And my grandfather was a Free Will Baptist pastor. And I don't know if you know much about what a Free Will Baptist is, but
I have no idea.
Yeah, no.
Okay. So later in life, when I was 11, we left the Free Will Baptist Church for reasons I'll tell you in a minute. We went Southern Baptist, and that was seen as a liberal move.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah, I'm familiar with Southern Baptist is how I grew up. So if that's the liberal move, damn.
Yeah, damn. That's right. You know, King James only, they didn't plan who was going to preach in the service. You would just, or the music, you would just show up and the Spirit would lead. And so like they'd pick songs on the fly. And then before the last song, before the sermon or message or whatever it was called back then, they would say, Brother so-and-so is going to preach. And you would see Brother so-and-so get out the most big ass Bible you've ever seen in your life and just start thumbing through. Waiting for the Spirit to give them something to say. Sometimes Brother so-and-so would open and Brother so-and-so would close, which meant, I guess we'd been very bad that week and needed a double dose of the sermon, which meant lunch was going to be a way off. So basically my grandfather was the pastor of that church. And when I was 11, he died in a church business meeting. And he died in a church business meeting, literally after somebody told him, you're the problem and you should go.
Wow.
He had a massive heart attack and died. And, you know, at 40, all of my categories for that have been worked out in a way that I, you know, understand what just a wicked, awful coincidence. At the time, though, that, you know, I had a very literal framework. My understanding of God was very literal. And, you know, for me, when people say, when did you start deconstructing your faith? Like consciously, I was in my early 20s, but actually I was 11, because I knew at 11 that whatever God set this thing up, was a problem. Yeah. And, you know, like it was, and so when after he died, we hung on for a little while, but then my parents wanted to get me into a church with a, you know, a youth group, because I think they had a sense of they were losing, like at least religiously, they were losing me, mm-hmm. if that makes sense, because I kind of decided secretly that, you know, I wasn't an atheist. I believe God existed, but I just wanted nothing to do with God. And so went into the Southern Baptist world, ended up, I was a shot Enneagram 7. That's, you know,
okay.
for cool. all the blessings and curses of that. And, but at the, you know, as a kid, I don't feel like, I don't know how that all works, because I definitely didn't feel like an Enneagram 7 as a kid, in the sense that I was really, really shy. I mean, I can see some of those traits, but super shy kid, would never have considered myself a leader in anything. And somehow I ended up in this new youth group, being a leader in this youth group, and got invited to give a sermon on a youth night, like a sermonette, I think is what they called it, a devotion on a youth night that our pastor was out of town. And I also had this debilitating sense of people pleasing. So I said yes immediately, and then spent the rest of like 2 weeks hoping I would get like the stomach bug to get me out of it, because I didn't want to get up in front of, talking in front of people, because that was terrifying. But I did it, and I gave this sermon on John 3:16 that lasted about 11 minutes. Wouldn't stand by it today, of course. But there was something about that moment that I was like, oh my gosh, whatever that was. And I don't know if that meant anything to anybody else, but it meant something to me. And I've got to do that again to figure out what that was. And so I started doing the preaching circuit. I have tons of horror stories from just traveling around rural Kentucky preaching, West Virginia. Ended up pastoring my home church, interim pastoring at 19.
Okay.
Kind of got freaked out because I thought they were going to offer me the job. Transferred to another school, got a few hours away from home, disastrously pastored a very small Baptist church there for less than a year. It was terrible.
What type of schooling were you I didn't mean to interrupt. I mean, I did, but what were you in Bible college at the time while you're pastoring? Cause that's not common. I don't think really.
Well, in the Southern Baptist, like this is what's so interesting. All my friends who are in denominations that are like, you have to be credentialed to be a pastor, and there's a process. Literally, the only thing you have to do to get the mic in the Southern Baptist world is a couple things. One, say you're called. Two, be a dude. Like, literally, the only that's what two I was requirements. So it's yeah. like, oh, he must be called. Let's let him preach.
Okay.
So I was actually going to school for writing. My okay. undergrad degree is in writing. And because I thought, I want to go get the public education experience before I go to seminary. And, you know, I'll witness to, which I was never good at. I never really witnessed to people. It was always uncomfortable for me. But I thought, you know, I'll go do this whole college thing. I'll save my roommates and then I'll go to seminary. And so I was just, you know, going for a writing degree, because honestly, I was the most uninspired kid you would have ever met. I had there was nothing that stood out to me other than once I got into like preaching. Otherwise, the reason I picked writing is because it was easy for me. I didn't have to work very hard at it.
Okay.
It was just, I was coasting, you know, at that point.
Okay. All right, cool. I interrupted your flow. I apologize. But like, so you were pastoring, you said, the small disastrous church at 19 while you're in school.
Yeah. I think I turned 20 at the time. So I was very old and wise.
Yeah. Yeah. You know everything at that point. It's the perfect time to pastor, honestly.
I actually feel like you're like a breath away from having been Josh Harris and not Josh Scott, the way you tell your story.
No. Yeah, had some PR people gotten behind you, you could have ended up in a very different place.
Yeah. It's a wonderful life kind of moment. And so like, it was so disastrous that I remember when we mutually parted ways, the head deacon, and it was a very small church, like two deacons, they're both related to each other. It was a very small church. But when they parted ways, he was like, you're a pretty good speaker, but you're a terrible pastor. And, you know, at the time I was super offended by that. He's actually right. Like, what did I know about pastoring people, you know, through the transitions of life at 20 years old when I hadn't really been through most of the transitions of life yet. So I ended up, you know, long story short, went through a year after college of working at a Chevy dealership in the service department doing paperwork, and did not feel like that was the best use of my energy. Ended up at a small church. It's small by mega church standards, but it was a, you know, kind of a medium sized community church in rural South Central Kentucky when I was 23. And what I didn't tell them when they hired me was that my faith was full on unraveling. I'd started, somebody gave me a Pneuma, these short films Rob Bell made in the early 2000s.
Yeah, I remember those.
I saw this one and I was like, oh my gosh. And so I started listening to Rob's sermons. And then I started like all of his recommended reading. I would write them down and go get them. And so I was reading Marcus Borg and Brian McLaren and John Dominic Crossan. And I was just full on down the rabbit hole. But then at 23, I get this church job. And so trying to figure out how to preach sermons that give people what they're looking for, which now I don't think is the job of a sermon, but then I thought it was the job of a sermon. To give people what they're looking for, and also not say anything that I felt like I was betraying myself. That was really hard. And I ended up staying there for 14 years, and it was quite the ride.
So you said earlier that you look like you're 25, or you didn't say that, but I would just confirm that that's true. You and Megan are both look like you're like, you know, way, way younger. I can't. So how many years ago, what year was this, that this 23 to 25 region?
05.
Okay. Early 2000s. I'm just trying to figure out, because I have a pretty good mind for like what was going on in church culture at that time. And so, yeah. Okay, cool. So 2005. Now you, Megan. Sorry.
No, I was just going to ask, knowing what you were going through with your faith transition, what drew you to go apply to be a pastor in the first place at that moment?
Lack of good sense, I guess. I love speaking. Like, I love to get up and give sermons, and I also love like the small dialogue. I just love being in conversation about these things. And that was true then. Like, I was learning so many things that I wanted to share with people. And I also, you know, so I loved this, and I spent my entire life kind of preparing to do this, not being equipped to do anything else. I mean, I didn't know what else I would do, like how else I would build a career. There was nothing else I was excited about. There was nothing else that, like, I had this one right out of college. I worked at a Walmart in Northern Kentucky for a week. And I worked in the lawn garden area. And this is how it went. They gave me a swing to put together. It took me 4 hours to put the swing together. I put the swing together backwards. It took me 4 more hours to take it apart and try to put it back together again. Didn't get it done. And when I left that shift, I was like, I think I need to rethink this. I don't think either one, this is not going to work out for either one of us. This is not what I'm not good at this. I have a very small skill. I feel like Liam Neeson in like the Taken movies. Like, I have very small set of skills, and those are iffy. Like, I got to do this.
Okay. Interesting. All right. So how did you navigate? What was the process? What did it look like for you to be beginning to listen to Rob Bell in the early 2000s, Brian McLaren? I mean, basically every book my youth pastor threw at me and said, this is horseshit, in Southern Baptist, obviously. What was that like for you, navigating that experience?
I'm slightly naive at times. So I'm excited about this. I'm just going to share it with people. Right. Because it didn't seem super heretical to me. And now, you know, like, I would read Marcus Borg at that time, you know, almost 20 years ago. And I would go, gosh, you know, I disagree with Borg's conclusions about the resurrection and that sort of thing. But his history that he infuses in his scholarship is brilliant. And so I would just start sharing the history, right? Like, here's what actually was going on behind these stories. There's an actual context and culture. There's subtext, and there's a lot of stuff we miss. And people would, you know, started to get into it. It's when my opinions on sort of the other stuff started to change that it became really difficult. I loathed for the longest time Christmas and Easter. Give me a random Tuesday in July. Just don't give me Christmas or Easter, because if I tell them the truth, it's going to go over like a lead balloon.
Yeah. And I guess as you're talking about reading these authors and thinking critically about them, did you find yourself giving yourself permission to approach the Bible the same way in all of your pastoring and everything? Because I think that's where a lot of folks in deconstruction, it takes a while to get there. Like, oh, wait, this is maybe an interpretation that I've been taught, but maybe there's other interpretations out there. What was that process of giving yourself permission to read the Bible differently?
You know, I think deep down, looking back on it, I always had a problem with the stuff I was preaching as an early, you know, late teen, early 20-year-old. I thought this is not, I don't know why this is good news, but it's true. So I have to preach it. And the minute I heard something else, and what was so stunning for me was being able to take what they were saying, like what Borg would be saying about something, and then actually go to the scripture, to the New Testament, and read it and be like, oh, I actually see what he's saying. And what he's saying makes way more sense.
Yeah.
So there really, for me, there was never this sort of like, I've got to hang on to this slavery. And there should have been. It was ingrained within me from the time I was 3-4 years old. I was memorizing Bible verses, right? So it was ingrained in me. But for some reason, it was like, see, oh, this is a breath of fresh air. I get to see this differently. And so it just felt like it was like hand in glove in some ways. And I mean, that's still a process that's ongoing for me. I've over the last year come to read some of Jesus' parables differently that I'm just as excited about as I was, you know, 15, 20 years ago when I was just starting this process. So it's an ongoing thing, but it really felt like it kind of, oh, okay, I found something better. I'll let go of this.
Okay. Okay. So I can't imagine that whatever church context you were in was just like, because I've never seen this happen, but maybe it did, but it's just like, all right, Josh is evolving and growing and moving, and we're just as a church going to rally around and change and evolve and grow with him. And now you continue to pastor that church and it's a totally different thing now today. Is that your story, or what? How did it go if it was differently than that?
No, yes, and no.
Oh, cool. I'm excited.
So in the beginning, the guy who was my youth pastor growing up was the youth pastor at this church. That's how I made the connection. And he was one of the, you know, he and some of his friends were some of my earliest resistors. But I also developed the ability that so many evangelical pastors develop to say things in such a way that the people in the room who were conservative could hear what they wanted to hear. And the people who leaned a little progressive in the room, which we didn't have very many at the time, of course, but they could hear what they wanted to hear. And I could feel like I gave a good, you know, almost progressive sermon today. When in reality, and what I learned over, you know, many years later, when people finally started getting what I was saying and leaving the church in droves, what I realized is I actually did them a disservice, because they were waking up going, whoa, 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 whoa. When you gave that sermon 10 years ago and you said the exact same thing you said today, did you mean it the way you meant it today? Yeah, I did. And so they felt a sense of betrayal, which is why I've adopted a policy of I'm going to be brutally clear about what I mean. And if I'm not, then I'll be even more brutally clear about what I mean, because I really felt like I did did people a disservice. And I was trying to save my own job and my own paycheck. And there are all sorts of reasons why. But now I look back, I have some regret around that. But there came a point in 2015 when we'd been on a journey and things had been happening in small groups. And I built up a core of people who were kind of with me that I sat down with our elders. We had an elder structure, sat down with our elders at the time and just laid out my theology from atonement theory or lack thereof to LGBTQ plus inclusion. I mean, to inerrancy and fallibility or the lack thereof. And I laid that out for my elders and just said, look, I realize that this may not be the journey that you and this church want to take. It is the journey I have to take. So if you want me to resign and you can find somebody to keep things the way they are, that's fine. I'll do that. And they, to a person, said, no, we believe this is our journey as a church. We should take this together. Now, a year later, most of them had left. But, you know, for that one moment, when the rubber hit the road, is that the metaphor? When the rubber hit the road, it was too much. Like, I remember having a phone call. There were several events over those years that were just so exciting. And then also there were other events that were just so traumatizing and painful with relationally with people. And I remember right before we sort of launched, maybe I can't remember if it was inclusion or I can't remember what it was we were doing. But I remember having a call with Brian McLaren, and Brian told me, he said, the thing that's going to be the most painful for you are the people who agree with you who still leave. because of social pressure. And I was like, oh, I know these people, that's not going to happen. And I'll never forget. It was after it was the 2016 election. And we lost more people over the stuff I said about Trump than we did about Atonement Theory or inclusion or any of those things in small rural Kentucky town. But I remember sitting across breakfast from somebody who I'd known for years, who said, you know, we agree with everything you've said recently, but we won't be back because we have to go to our family at Thanksgiving. And we have to go to the grocery store, and we don't want to answer questions about our church the entire time. And that was like just a major gut punch. And so there were all sorts of moments like that, like, you know, being a pastor leading a conservative church to becoming a progressive church. Being a pastor in lots of ways generally is like an emotional roller coaster, but specifically in this sort of journey and the context we did it in, it was a lot.
Yeah, dude. Fuck. I mean, I'm impressed and amazed that everything that you said happened, like, was able to have, like, happen, like,
yeah.
Like, because I think that there's that social pressure you talk about that people in your church and your elders face, but like, that's compounded 100 times for somebody in your position, right? Because you feel, I mean, just from reflecting back onto being in those types of positions in ministry, you feel that social pressure for yourself and for everybody else, that you are causing this schism, you know, in their, you know, reality. And yeah, so that's wild that happened that way. And I feel for you.
So I'm curious then, how did that turn into Grace Point? I don't want to jump ahead if I'm skipping something, but I know that I first heard of your work because I feel like Grace Point is out there in the world as a church that is about what you're about. And so that kind of came to me. And then when you know, you and I have connected on Twitter, but how did that transition happen where you then, did you plant Grace Point or how did that happen?
No, I didn't. You know, I'm super grateful for Grace Point. You know, it's Christmas time right now. I'm in a series where every week I've just basically been teaching, deconstructing the virgin birth in different ways, and they're just here for it. So, nice. You know, I'm super grateful to be in a community where they're like, yeah, let's get to the actual meaning of this. Grace Point is, you know, probably close to 20 years old now. I was friends with the founding pastor. And so the church I was at in Grace Point, geographically, are about an hour and a half apart. And I became familiar with Grace Point in 2014 because we were going through this process. And anytime one of those speakers that I loved and had meant a lot to me would come close, I would just go stalk them. And so Brian McLaren was coming. I looked on his calendar. He's coming to Grace Point. I'm like, what's Grace Point? Who's Grace Point? There's another church in this region that would host Brian. That's incredible.
Yeah. Usually a pretty good litmus test.
Right? Yeah. So I called the office and was like, hey, can I bring some of my people down? We're going through Brian's new book, We Make the Robot Walking. Could we come down and just hang out and listen on Sunday night? And they're like, sure. And so that night I met Stan Mitchell, who was the founding pastor of Grace Point. And we developed a friendship. I developed a friendship with some other people on staff there and some of the people in the community. We would sort of do things. They would come up and speak at my church, and we would collaborate on some things. And in 2015, Grace Point came out affirming. It was Epiphany Sunday, and Stan issued an inclusion statement that kind of sent shockwaves because Grace Point had been traditionally kind of evangelical, at least on the surface. Lots of evangelical folks went there. And when that happened, it sent shockwaves through the evangelical community. Everybody who thought, you know, Grace Point is us, and Grace Point, you know, clearly wasn't us. And so we were doing that same work about the same time. And Grace Point went through sort of what we did in Kentucky, which was not just sort of around LGBTQ+ inclusion. That was a big moment, but there was this whole other set of stuff that needed to be wrestled with and deconstructed. And so, you know, began that journey. The way I ended up at Grace Point was in 2018. I had a sense that my time in Kentucky probably was coming. I'd been there 14 years. And, you know, whether anybody likes it or not, when you're a leader, you build up what, I don't know what the best language to use for it is, but like some sort of like currency or something that at times you cash in for really critical things, right? So as a leader, people trust you and they go with you and you prove yourself to them. And then you say, I need you to go with me here. And you cash it in for LGBTQ plus inclusion, or you cash it in to say, we're, you know, we've been thinking about atonement theory wrong, or you, you know, you do it along. And I just felt like I've spent everything and it was just hard. Like I couldn't go to the grocery store without having an awkward sort of moment with a former congregant or, you know, it was just, and I almost felt like I'd become in that really small town, a very big lightning rod for other churches. And so I actually always felt like other pastors who use, you know, me in our church for like sermon illustrations or whatever, or that we sent members to who left us, like nobody ever said thank you to me. Nobody ever sent me an edible arrangement. It was, you know, I just felt like I'm really resourcing you all with a lot of material here. But I just felt like, you know, I'm at the point, I feel like that if this thing's going to be able to become sustainable and get over the hump, it probably needs to do without me. But I didn't feel released completely emotionally. And when Stan reached out to me, long story short, from, you know, fall of 2018 through spring of 2019, I was in conversation with them. And then I started at Grace Point on Easter of 2019. And then we went, you know, had a year and almost, and then went right into a pandemic. And that's been really interesting to navigate.
Yeah. I can't imagine.
Yeah. And I think one thing that I think about, and I wonder about this with my own pastor, because we're a progressive church too, and in the midst of deconstruction community, and there's a lot of religious trauma and people, you know, with a lot of different degrees of what feels safe and what feels right. And some people just kind of walk away altogether or keep church at a distance. And I've always wondered, when you're the pastor, there's some of that, you know, and you're a pastor of a progressive church. And so you have a little bit of freedom, you know, within the deconstruction world, but there's some of that where you're tethered and you don't have as much of an option to hold church loosely and hold the structure of things loosely. And I just wonder how that all comes together for you and how you kind of manage that in your role, knowing that this is your job, this is what you do.
Yeah. I sometimes wonder if I do my job really well, if I'm not working myself out of it. And I mean, what I mean by that is, I think that there are moments I've done this. Well, I have like 15 things to say now, so I'll try to organize them in my brain really
quickly. Say them all. Write them all down.
We're here for it.
So first of all, one of the things I always tell people is, I think that the right pastoral response to somebody who's been harmed by the church is not to say, well, stay, and let me fix it. I think the right response, and the thing I say to people sometimes, is I think you stepping away is the right thing. And maybe you stepping away is the right thing for now, and maybe it's the right thing forever. But for now, maybe that's the right choice for you. And so, you know, I think people are leaving the church, and they should be. And a lot of these situations, all of these situations.
Yeah.
And so, what I also will tell people is, if you've lost church and you have grief around that, so not me trying to sell you Jesus or the church like a used car, right? But like, don't look under the hood. Like if you have grief, you miss this community, you miss these conversations, you're not finding that somewhere else. You're looking for a place to belong. You're looking for a place to belong and be, you know, and be contentious. Maybe that's not the right, what's the word I'm looking for? But so like, you're not swallowing, you know, anything hook, line, and sinker. You're just here. You have an opinion. You have perspective. You want to engage. Like what I want to do is I want to help give that back to you. And I say the same about the Bible. There are people who've been so hurt by the Bible that they've walked away from it. And I would never say to them, oh, but you really should be reading the Bible. Actually, maybe they shouldn't. Maybe the Bible has been so painful and so used as a weapon against them that them putting the Bible down and never picking it up again, selling all their copies, dropping them off at hotels. I don't know what happens to used Bibles, but like doing something like maybe walking away from the Bible is the right thing. But if there's part of you that has grief around that, like, I've lost the Bible, it's been taken from me by people who have weaponized it, people who have poorly understood it, first of all, and weaponized it. And you have grief around that. I want to help you be able to access that again in a different way. So, you know, I think that the ethical job of a pastor is not to try to keep people who don't want to be kept. And I think the way most of us are trained to be pastors, it's much more like from the Pepe Le Pew school, which I think we all have a problem with now, hopefully, right? Which is like, if people don't want you to hold on to them, don't hold on to them. Mm-hmm. Let them know if they want a place to belong, that there's a place to belong. So I just have, I think the ethical thing for a pastor to do is to be honest about that and say, look, it may be the best thing for you to leave. And that may be the best way for you to get to your fullest, most complete humanity. Because ultimately, my hermeneutic, the way I approach all of this, the goal for me is human flourishing. And so whatever human flourishing looks like, it looks different for different people. For some people, you know, it looks like them being a part of a faith community where they're talking about these things and that gives them life and energy. And, you know, I don't know if you've read any of my stuff or listened to any of my sermons, but, you know, I take a pretty non-literal approach to all this, and I'll probably be a Christian for the rest of my life, not because I think there's an afterlife I'm trying to angle into, but because the Christian tradition is my mother tongue. I love the Bible. I really do. I love talking about it. I'm a Bible nerd at heart, but not everybody's that way. And so I just want people to flourish and become their most full, best selves. And if that's with the church, if that's without the church, if that's with the church on Easter and Christmas, or if that's at the church all the time, but you stay at home on Easter and Christmas because trauma, like, that's okay. That's okay. Our job is to help get people into the lane that helps them flourish. And that's how I see my role. I'm just trying to help people find where that place is for them, whether it's in a community or without a community, the church community.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a couple questions specifically, just because my relationship with church has changed so dramatically over the last several years. And two things that I think I'd be curious to get your kind of insight on. One is, I feel like my experience in participating in Christian community as a non-Christian has been far superior to my experience in participating in Christian community as a Christian. And so I'm curious, like, why, through, you know, kind of in your perspective, why that might be for me, because I can engage pretty healthily in Christian community. I'm not super triggered by Christian language or Christian tradition. I actually really love and enjoy a lot of Christian tradition. And I love Christian community, but I've just found that I'm much more welcome and treated much more warmly as a non-Christian than as a Christian. In most Christian community, because I'm not held to a particular litmus test as a non-Christian. I'm the atheist guy who likes to come to small group or comes to church on Sunday, or, you know, in general, I get probably more pleasant treatment because I'm the atheist guy.
You're probably getting a lot of prayer, Cortland.
Probably. Maybe that's why life is so good for me. It's like I'm just getting all this prayer. But yeah, I feel like, and I don't know if that's just because I've never experienced trying again to identify as Christian. And maybe it would be different going back into it now. But curious your take on that. And then secondarily, I have another point, but I'd like to hear your point on that first.
So are you, this kind of Christian community, is it more conservative, liberal, progressive? What would you?
I would say both. So I got relatively involved in like this Christian, it was an E-free church that I had a crush on this girl. And so she was E-free and I was like, oh yeah, I'll go to church with you. My wife was like, the fuck are you doing? Like, she clearly knew I was into this girl because she was like, why are you going to church?
I feel like Jesus should have had a parable that started at a point who, because of a crush, has not joined a church at some point in their life. Like,
yeah, she was, it was so apparent, but I met these people and I was like, oh, this community is really cool. I got invited to several people's houses for lunch, like day one. And I'm as a very social Enneagram 7. I'm like, yeah, I'll come to your house. I'll have lunch. That sounds great. And I realized like, oh, this is a really cool community. And it became a space where I made a lot of friends and participated in small groups. Ultimately, the church's theology I couldn't get involved in that church. They're not affirming. They're not egalitarian. I mean, there's a lot of problems. But the people who I met there were all super cool to me, coming in as a non-believer. They were like, you're welcome here. We want you here. We don't really.
I'm afraid to tell you my answer now because I don't want to ruin that experience for you.
Yeah, I mean, it was a good experience, and it went on for a while. And then I've also had experiences. I'm not as involved anymore. Me and the girl fizzled out. So, but I also have been involved in churches like House for All Sinners and Saints, right, which is here in Denver. Nadia Bolts Weber's the founding pastor, I believe, of Half Ass. She's not pastoring there anymore. I think Pastor Reagan is there currently. And I've gone to Half Ass, and I've really enjoyed participating in liturgy there and all of that sort of thing. But again, it just feels, I feel more comfortable participating as a non-believer than I do, because I feel like if I identify as Christian, then there's this particular, I don't know, maybe it's trauma. I just like, there's a standard that's going to be put on me. And I feel that I can get the full experience without having to be a Christian, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of me, I really don't want to ruin the experience. Part of me thinks that in some settings, people would be, I mean, Christians have always been super nice to unbelievers or atheists or whatever, right? Like we were kind of taught to be nice to people.
Yeah.
With the ulterior motive of, we're just going to nice them into believing this is a good thing. And we'll convert them. I don't know that that was the case you were experiencing.
Probably. I'm just unconvertible. So like, I was like, I'll just continue to enjoy the free lunches.
Now, you know, for me also, you're right. There in many Christian contexts, there would be, because the minute you say you identify as Christian, now you're responsible for all these like shitty creeds and all these beliefs that come with that. Especially churches that are heavy on like doctrinal positions and doctrinal beliefs. Which is just the thing I can't do. Like for me to be Christian, it is very much about, I see a message in Jesus that, at least the way I've come to understand it, challenges the status quo of the world and the way we've carved it up. Nothing to do with the afterlife, nothing to do, like everything to do with how this world gets run. And so I want to be about that. The stuff that gets in the way is the doctrine and the dogma and the creeds. And all of that. Well, now, like, you have to believe this in order to be a part of this. Creeds are inherently exclusionary. You create them to keep people out and to keep people in, because walls and fences work both ways, right? They keep people out, but they also keep people in. And so I wonder if partly that experience is that you get to enjoy all of that without all the baggage of doctrine and dogma, right? Like, you can enjoy the liturgy and go, gosh, yeah, I don't think anything magical just happened there. It, outside of the fact that I think when human beings get together, I actually did a sermon on worship through Progressive Christian Lynch a couple weeks ago at Grace Point. And my whole point was, actually, when we get together, whatever's happening here, it's horizontal, not vertical. Like, this is about us getting together and doing something together that means something for us together. It opens our eyes to the world around us. Whatever we mean by the word God, and I always try to phrase it like that, because I think the minute you try to define whatever you mean by the word God, you've immediately created something that can't live up to the hype. Whatever that experience is, like, we're here together trying to say, like, see me. I want to see you. You see me. Let's see each other, and let's try to go out into the world with our kind of the blinders off and see the people around us and see all the opportunity to do good and love our neighbor and combat injustice. And without doctrine and dogma, that's kind of what you get, right? You get the actual Jesus, not the Jesus that the church created.
I want to jump in here, because I think this is, Cortland and I have spoken about this before, because we kind of fall on different sides of this, because I have a hard time sometimes with communities that still hold to a theology that I think perpetuates harm, right? And so I'm wondering what your take is on, do you, I know, like, on Twitter and things like that, I'll do a lot of, like, if you're holding to this sexual ethic, this is harmful. Or if you're calling this the quote unquote biblical sexual ethic, this is harmful. And I have a hard time, I guess, having tolerance or patience with people that I think are still perpetuating that harm. And so, this is something Cortland and I have talked about too, but I would just love to get your take. Do you feel like there's this sense of, we need to be calling this out? Or do you think that it's more like, let's just let them stay in their lane, let's stay in our lane, and let's just all kind of go at life in our own lanes kind of thing?
My life would be easier if I thought we should let them stay in their lane. No, I don't think, I think we call out things that are, that perpetuate harm and that are damaging people. I think we have to, and look, here's the thing. If I thought tomorrow that if progressive Christian, like if it took every church of every stripe folding to get rid of like the harmful stuff, I would be for it. But I don't think that's actually what will happen, right? Like if all of us progressive leaning Christians folded up, the conservative fundamental religious right Christians would still be there and they would still be perpetuating harm. It's also why I don't want to give them all the language. It's why I refuse to let go of the Bible, why I refuse to let go of Christian language, because I think they've used and abused it and they've actually misunderstood it and they've harmed people with it. And so I call it out. And I see you doing that, Megan, and I do it too. And sometimes I do it and I'm like, oh, what did, like every time, like when there's a senator in Tennessee who quotes Bible verses, her name's Marsha. And Marsha just says the worst things and the most harmful things. And every time I'm like, don't do it, because you're going to say something on her post and you are going to get MAGA Christianed to death. And it happens every time because I can't stop myself, because what I see being put out into the world, it's harmful and it's damaging. And I also have the ability to say something about it. I don't, you know, like not like the six people who listen to me, like I can at least say I said something that those six people heard, and maybe it will give them a different way of thinking about it. And I also like the way I pitch this now is I have no desire to convert a non-Christian to Christianity. If there are non-Christians who are happy and living their lives, why in the world would I want to mess with that? I'm all about human flourishing. I want to convert Christians to a better kind of Christianity. And what makes it better is it doesn't hurt people. Mm. And so I'm all about, like, there are times when I see a right-wing preacher say something online, I'll invite them to repent and trust Jesus, because I think that's what they need to do, because they actually haven't done it. They actually haven't met this compassionate human being who they claim to follow, right? Like they've met a version of Jesus that hurts people. And I want to invite people to a version of Jesus, to an understanding of Jesus. Like there was this human life that existed 2,000 years ago, who lived, who upset a bunch of people, who was anti-empire, and the empire killed him for it. His life was so powerful that after his death, his followers still said they experienced his presence with them. I want to invite people to experience that. And so I think that means when we see damage, when we see harm, when we see trauma being perpetuated, like, you know, this video going around today, which will mean nothing probably to whoever's listening to this whenever it comes out. But the
3 or 4 weeks from now, but yeah.
Matt Chandler video where he's like, deconstruction sexy and you never knew Jesus. No, actually, maybe you never knew Jesus.
Yeah.
Yep.
Matt, maybe you never knew. Maybe the Jesus you inherited was a Jesus that was so Greco-Roman demigod that he actually doesn't live up. He doesn't live up to the actual historical figure. And maybe and I tweeted that video today because I felt like what he was saying was so harmful. Nobody deconstructs because it's sexy. What the hell? Nobody deconstructs because it's the easy thing to do. And actually, nobody even picks to, like, you don't wake up on a random Thursday and go, I'm going to deconstruct my faith today, lose so many friendships, make holidays weird with my family, perhaps lose a marriage or a partnership, get in a weird bind with the people I've known my entire life. Nobody wakes up and does that. It is something that happens to you. Maybe it happens to you. It's a process you're invited into. And that's not even the question you asked, but that's what happens when you say to a person who talks regularly, hey, say something about this.
Can relate.
Yeah. And I would love for you to talk a little bit about, I know one of the first times that we really started communicating a little bit more often was I had said something on Twitter about pastors that preach about deconstruction. And I said something like, it's never not triggering. And you responded and was like, hey, I actually did preach about deconstruction and I I would love for you to check it out and let me know what you think. And actually, you weren't the only pastor that responded and said that. And so I started to watch another sermon that somebody sent me and I was like, no way, because I knew immediately. And then I looked him up on Church Clarity and I was like, oh yeah, all those red flags, those, you know, were legit. And then I watched yours and I was like, wow, I felt a lot more seen than I had ever in watching pastors preach about deconstruction. And I would love for you not to preach a sermon, but to just give like your thought that the way that you approach deconstruction when you talk about it in a way that does make people in the deconstruction community feel connected and seen and known versus these hot takes that are floating around saying, you know, you're deconstructing because you want to have sex and sin and all these things.
Yeah. I would just, I feel like I'm smoking what I'm selling. Like I'm not talking from outside of it. I've been through it. I'm going through it. It's my life. It's my journey. And so, you know, when hot takes come across like Matt Chandler's, or I mean, you take any, I mean, every day it seems like another pastor says a dumb thing about deconstruction. And you can tell either one, they've never been through it, or like I don't think most of these people are stupid. I think most of these people are grifting.
Hmm.
And what they're trying to do is they're trying to keep their members and their budgets. Right? Oh, don't go to the sexy deconstruction thing. Stay here. Give me your money. Mm-hmm. That's what'll make you feel fulfilled. I try never to speak about things I have not had experience of which I have not experienced. Sorry, English degree. And so I just feel like that's disingenuous. Like, I'm never going to give sermons that I can't stand behind and say, I gave that sermon because that's something I know about, because I know it in my bones, but I know it through experience. I know it through my own journey. And so I think when I talk about deconstruction, I'm in the sermon I think I sent you, which I actually is something I would rarely ever do. So I don't know why I even sent it to you, but sorry.
Megan's the type of person that's cool. She's cool with it.
To be fair, I think like, I asked, you said that, and then I think I asked, send it to me and I'll watch it. I don't think it was just random.
Okay. Well, good, because I would like
Josh got out here proselytizing on Twitter.
Yeah.
We got you. I'm just kidding.
That sermon, and I can't even remember it at this point, but I think one of the things I said when I shared it on social media was, this is a sermon I wish somebody had given 10, 20 years ago for me. Because when I was going through, like, people weren't using the word deconstruction when things started for me. There was no deconstruction community. Twitter didn't exist. Facebook didn't exist, right? Like, it was, for me, it was literally, I'm in a small town and I'm alone. And I would throw in certain things when I would meet people to know if they were safe to talk to about it. Like, I remember sitting down with another pastor going, so who are you reading? He's like, why are you trying to figure out if I'm safe? I was like, actually, yes. I need your book list.
Yeah.
So for me, like, when I started out, there was no net, there was no community, there was no social media, there was nowhere to find any sort of camaraderie. And so that sermon, whatever sermon it was, but I remember feeling it at the time, like, I wish somebody would have set me down at a, you know, wherever we were, and just said, hey, by the way, and just shared that with me. And what really devastates me when I see videos of these pastors, these clips that they put on TikTok and, you know, go viral, of them saying terrible things about people in the deconstruction community and what they're going through, is that it's actually just compounding trauma.
Yeah.
It's actually whatever their goal is. Like, the goal is not to help people. The goal is to help themselves, which I think if you are actually in this for the right reasons, then at some point you have to let go of self-preservation and just say, if I really want to help people, like, there's a certain freedom of getting to the point and saying, maybe I'm working myself out of a job. Maybe,
yeah.
maybe. But if that's the case, if it helps people, if it leads to human flourishing, if my job, and I think, I hope, my deepest hope for Christianity is that progressive Christianity is the future, right? Like, that a more liberative Christianity is the future. But if my job is to provide palliative care, if my job is to provide hospice care for this faith and the people who are leaving it, they're leaving their faith and they need to be guided out with compassion and gentleness. Mm. I'll keep showing up to work every day because that is a deeply holy task. Helping people lose something that has meant the world to them and has shaped their life and come out on the other side and find. And I just find this all the time when I'm sitting down for coffee or grabbing drinks with somebody who's like, who has been so wounded by church that they can't even begin to possibly want to even be back. But there's something they're so curious about where somebody like me is in the world saying the things I'm saying. And I just sense in them, what they need is somebody to help them through they just need somebody to sit down with them and tell them, actually, you're not bad. This is not a phase. Whatever happens to you on the other side of this, your faith previously held is going away. And there's grief there and there's anger there and there should be. I went through it. If I could go back, which fortunately I think that they should be all off the internet now because that website has changed. But if I could go back and delete all my sermons from like 2005 to 2000, like 15, 14, I would. I was pissed off. Mm. I felt like I'd been lied to. Right? Like nobody told me there were options.
Yeah. I really appreciate the space that you're talking about and the work that you're talking about. And it's been really cool doing this with Megan this season of this show, just because I think her perspective and experience adds a different layer. And I hope listeners pick up on this too, just like what she brings to the conversation. You know, we interviewed Pastor Judy, who's the walking pastor. I don't know if you're familiar with her work, but, you know, talking about this very similar experience of being hospice workers, you know, in the faith, you know, and I look at, you know, people like you, people like Danny Prada down in Florida with Heartway. People like Richard Rohr, right? Who are redeeming language. We talk about, you know, Rachel Held Evans and the work that she was doing. I feel like for people like myself, who I resound much more with Brady Harden from Life After, right? He's angry a little bit, you know, he's like, you know, full out atheist, quote unquote, deconstructed all the way. Oftentimes I resound with these people who are maybe on the far side. But I also feel a very kinship and like a draw, like an aspect of drawing towards people who are still in the space, because I still have part of me. If I talk to a non-Christian, if I talk to a Christian, I'm an atheist. If I talk to a non-Christian, I'm oftentimes a Christian, according to them, at least, you know, because I still do have so much love for it. And so anyway, that was a long way of saying thank you for the work that you're doing. And I think that there is a ton of need in that space to be doing that in the way that you're doing it. And I hope more people see it as a actual option for them to do ministry in that sort of way, because I don't think that anyone really saw that as an option when, you know, like you were talking about back in 2005, there was no way to do church that way, at least being modeled.
I didn't even know John Shelby Spong existed in 2005. Right. And now if I were to say the person who's had the biggest impact on my faith in the last 5 years, my whatever the word faith means, right? Like it doesn't mean woo-woo for me, but it would be Spong, right? Like he is this guy, when you read his books, he is so hard on Christian faith and the people who propagate it. And then he's also like, they will never. And of course he unfortunately passed recently, but he's like, they'll never kick me out. Like I will be Christian. And that's, you know, I want to see a Christian expression that makes as much sense to atheists and agnostics, that makes as much, you know, that makes sense to people who are like, I can't go literal about a lot of this stuff, any of it maybe, but I do want to see a world where justice rolls like a river. I do want to see a world where where we stop interpreting the stories of Jesus within the context of capitalism as if that's what he meant. Like I just, you know the story of the widow's mite. Like, my whole new thing is we've misread that story for 2000, well, not 2000 years, about 1500 or so years, because we've turned that into a heroic, oh, she gave all she had to live on, when Jesus was actually saying any system that would take everything she has to live on is a corrupt system. Mm. Like, we need communities that are saying that and that are organizing around that. And so, my friends will often say, hey, do you know so-and-so in the progressive world? I'm like, yeah. And they're like, how do you know so many of them? Like, there aren't many of us.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
like if we were like, we could have the convention hall at like a rallies, like it would, you know what I mean? Like, but I do think there's something hopeful there, and a Christian faith that is less grounded in the miraculous, but more grounded in some ways, less grounded in like the woo-woo miraculous, but grounded in the miraculous that we can achieve if we all show up and do our part here in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. That's beautiful. I love it. I'm a fan. I say this to people all the time. I'm a fan of what you're doing. It's great work.
Yeah. I know we're getting close to the end, wrapping up and everything, but I would love for you to talk a little bit about people that aren't in Nashville, where they can find you. And I know, and kind of the work that you're doing aside from your pastoring, I know you have a newsletter. I don't know if that's connected to Grace Point, and just some of the stuff that you're doing on social media so people can know where to connect with you.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I write, usually I try to write weekly, but I'm at Enneagram 7. So there you go.
always so having a good time. Corland is too. Corland is too.
It's understood.
So I write, it's a Substack page, but I've got a domain name. It's joshscott.online. And you can go there to read or subscribe. And then you can follow me on social media at josh_a_scott. You can find Grace Point at gracepoint.net. We have a YouTube page. We live stream at 10:30 Central every Sunday. Our gathering, we're currently going through a series on deconstructing the Christmas stories. And we have a weekly hangout on Wednesday nights at 6:30 Central, which is called, right now it's called Reconstruct. We're going to probably change that. I keep saying we're going to, but now if I put, like I told a group of people yesterday, if I put it out enough places, I have to change it because I don't think reconstruction is the goal. And so, but it's a place, Megan, I think Megan, you've been.
Yeah, I've come into that. That's been a good time.
Yeah. So we do that on Wednesday nights on Zoom. You can find all that at Grace Point with an E. You got to put the E on Grace Point. It's because it's fancy. It's like Grace Point E. Because you know, if you go to a place where, if you go to a shop with an E on the end, you know,
yeah, it's fancy.
Cafe, and it's fancy, which we're absolutely not. We meet in a bar on Sunday mornings in Nashville.
You meet in kind of a famous bar, like Third and Lindsley. It's in like Song Lyrics. It's a music venue, right?
Yeah, it's a music venue. It's a nightclub. It's, you know, you come in on Sunday morning and the tables are sticky and, it's just right where you want to be. It's holy ground.
I love that. I love that. Some of my best church experiences have been in old, sticky, smelly bars. So that's wonderful.
I don't know if I'd say church experiences for me, but spiritual experiences for sure.
Same difference. So, yeah. Josh, thank you so much for making the time and spending time with us today. And I'm excited to share this interview with people. And I think there's a lot of people who are looking to connect in a space like what you're creating. And I'm grateful as somebody, quote unquote, on the outside for what you're doing. I hope you keep it up and we'll be rooting for you.
Thanks. I'm a fan of both of you and what you're doing in the world. And so I'm like to get to be on the show you're a fan of. That's a good time.
Cool. Thank you so much.
Yeah,
Megan,
you.
Anything else?
No, that's good. That's a wrap.
All right. Well, we said we were going to do a short intro and now we're in the outro. After that wonderful interview with Josh.
Always great chatting with Josh.
He's
a great human.
I do really like him. And he's like a wonderful person to be connected to on Twitter. If you use Twitter, go and follow Josh Scott on Twitter. And we'll put it in the show notes. He said it in the interview where you can connect with him. But just such a like open to connect type of guy. And I really appreciate that.
Yeah. And I would also encourage people to check out, they do on Wednesdays, they do an open Zoom conversation, and people, I've gone in before and people Zoom in from all over. It's not just people from church, but they used to call it Reconstruct, and no longer, it's going to be called Reimagine now. And it's on their church website, but it's really just no agenda conversation. Sometimes people are talking movies and pop culture, and I'll show up with a random question sometimes, and people just dive in. So check it out if you're interested, because he loves, as you can see in the interview, he loves having dialogue. He loves connecting with people, and he also can connect people with each other. So,
yeah, yeah. So before I give the standard spiel, I know we got another review on Apple Podcast. Megan, you want to shout out?
Yeah, it was an old college friend of mine, Erin. She's been listening, and she lives in New York City. And I said, you know, I'm sorry it's long. And she said, no, I have a really long commute to work, and I love it. And so she started listening, and she's been DMing me and saying she loves it. So thank you, Erin, for giving us a review on Apple Podcasts.
Yes, yes. We love the reviews on Apple Podcasts. And I know, like, it is one of those things I'm not always the best at. I will love a podcast or a product or a movie or a musician or an album or whatever. And like going to leave a review always feels like a lot of work, but it's really quick. It's really easy. If you have an Apple Podcast account, if you have an Apple ID, which you have to have if you have an iPhone, so no excuse there if you have one of those, go to Apple Podcast, look up there after podcast, leave us a quick rating review. It really goes a long way to help us get more folks hearing about the show and just seeing us, and gives people a little idea of what the show's about and what listeners think before they listen. Like always, if you would like to not miss an episode, you can like, follow, subscribe on all podcast platforms, whether it's Apple, Spotify, Overcast, Pocket Catcher, all of the platforms we're out there. Follow us on social media. Instagram, we're Thereafter Podcast. On Twitter, we're Thereafter Pod. We're going to get more active. We haven't been super active on Instagram. Megan is, of course, really active on our Twitter, so that's a great way to connect with us. I am Cortland Coffee across all social platforms. And Megan, how do people
And you can find me at The Pursuing Life. And we love to hear from our listeners too. So reach out either through our social media or either of us individually. It's always fun to hear from people. And one last thing, it's been a while since we gave a shout out to Cody, our editor. So thanks, Cody, for all you do, because we would not have this show without Cody.
Yes, we really appreciate him putting together all these episodes and doing the work that Megan and I could not do on our own. So, and doing it every single week. It's been really fun to be able to put out episodes every single week, and we want to continue doing that. So, as always, we want to shout out him. And if you have a podcast or a project, or you're looking to start a podcast, hit us up and we'll connect you, because he's a great resource for that and is always open to working on other shows and other projects. So that being said, we will catch you guys next week. As always, every Tuesday morning, we'll be dropping a new episode into wherever you get your podcasts.
Until next time.